Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. COVID-19 has brought on an influx of patients in intensive care units, and among the many difficult issues challenging healthcare workers are ethical concerns, not only surrounding triage and the withdrawal of life support, but also regarding family visits and the quality of end-of-life support. Joining us now is Dr. Ginny Sprang from the University of Kentucky Department of Psychiatry, where her focuses include the stress experienced by professionals who are exposed to others' trauma, so healthcare workers and others on the often highly stressful front lines of this pandemic. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Sprang.
Thank you for having me.
And first, tell us what sorts of psychological issues and disorders you're seeing and hearing from those frontline workers, the nurses, doctors, EMT crews, and others who are working directly with patients diagnosed with COVID-19.
So there's a range of conditions based on the experiences and the levels of exposure that different healthcare workers or behavioral healthcare workers might experience. One that we talk a lot about and that we're seeing with COVID is something called secondary traumatic stress. So this is a trauma condition that is caused by indirect exposure to other people's trauma. So, for example, we know that healthcare workers see the effects of people, you know, coming into the emergency room who've been the victims of violence. They hear people tell their stories about suffering and exposures to traumatic events. They have to repeat those stories to other professionals, child protection professionals, the authorities, public health officials, maybe even the courts. And in doing so, over time, we see professionals develop a condition called secondary traumatic stress, which parallels post-traumatic stress disorder. And we do know that with COVID, because of the loss of life, because of the suddenness, the uncertainty, that some of these experiences professionals are experiencing as traumatic. And so that's one condition that we're paying close attention to. Another is this issue called moral distress. And, you know, moral distress basically comes about when you think you know the right thing to do based on your morals, your ethics, your professional training, but there's some reason why you can't do that. Either it's a bureaucratic structure, it's a policy, it's circumstance. A good example would be someone comes in, they're suffering, they have significant medical needs, but they don't have insurance to pay for those services. And so you might feel as a professional, they're getting something else, something less than the ideal quality of care because of insurance. And to be the one to deliver something that you think is really not the right thing for them can cause moral distress, which can make you have symptoms of, you know, personal job dissatisfaction, sleeplessness, feeling in conflict with those around you, a lot of generalized distress at not being able to do the right thing. And then, of course, there's burnout. And burnout is a condition that is really based on working long hours with inadequate resources and being in a situation where you're overwhelmed by your responsibility. It's not a trauma exposure, but it is a condition that can lead people to leave their jobs and feel dissatisfied with their work and even disengage from their work. So these are all some conditions that we consider. And then you think about these things in the context of COVID, and that's just really added another layer of complexity. So there's uncertainty for the professionals, their job security may be uncertain, their own risk of infection and contagion is always looming large. They may be asking themselves, what is the risk to my family by me doing my job? Am I bringing this contagion home? And will we have what we need to be safe in the workplace? Do we have the right PPE? Do we have the right medications? Will there be enough ventilators? And of course, you know, that's all in the context of working with patients who also are facing uncertainty. And so this changes the dynamics, I think, of the relationship and can really interfere with the positive, which is compassion satisfaction. And that's this joy that we derive from executing our duties with professionalism and in a very helpful manner. And it's important that we have that compassion satisfaction because that's why we got into the business in the first place. And so that gets us through the tough times, and that can really be undermined by all this uncertainty.
There's a wonderful passage in the New York Times that goes like this. Of all the ways the coronavirus pandemic has undermined the conventions of normal life, perhaps none is as cruel as the separation of seriously ill patients and their loved ones, now mandated at hospitals around the world. What about the separation of patients from families? There have been stories about patients suddenly completely cut off from their loved ones, not being allowed to visit to prevent the spread of the virus. But what about the people who have to make those decisions and then enforce those rules? What sort of toll does that take on them?
Well, I think we all understand the logic behind the separation. We want to slow the spread of disease. We want to keep people safe. But that these types of decisions run contrary to everything we know about attachment and grief and, you know, the very essence of life. As professionals, we're trained to follow these set rules, these established protocols. But when the rules are in opposition to what we would want for ourselves or our loved ones, I think that creates a lot of moral distress that we just discussed earlier. And, you know, as professionals, we're compelled by this moral imperative to do no harm. That's kind of at the essence of who we are as professionals. And so watching a person come to the end of their life and dying alone is harmful. It's not what we would want. It's harmful to the patient and to the person who's having to witness it. And I think if you're in a situation where you're being the proxy for absent family members, you're being put in this space with a high dose of exposure to death and dying from a different perspective. And so that requires us to kind of lower the professional shield and share our humanity in some way. And in doing so, we share the loss. And that can be really painful. You know, as professionals, we've learned to keep our professional distance. But when you're sitting at the bedside and holding the hand of a dying person, you have to kind of let go of that professional shield and be present with them. Some people can't do that, make that shift. It's too threatening, or maybe they're too busy. And that can cause profound guilt in those that, you know, worry about the missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Here we are now into fall, cooler weather. We are beginning to see an uptick in cases across the country. The situation that we're in has raised concerns about the increased risk of death for patients who don't have COVID-19, but who also need to be admitted to an ICU, but may not be admitted because perhaps all the beds have been taken by coronavirus patients. How do decisions like this weigh on those who have to make them?
Well, I don't think anyone should have to make such a decision. That is, you know, what it boils down to. However, very practically, it's about who has the best chance of surviving with whatever intervention is available. But I think even with the most sophisticated algorithms and science to guide us, there's still the fact that this is still a relatively new virus, and the best way to respond is evolving. So the uncertainty that underlies the decision-making in these situations, I think, really dictates how people will judge their own actions and those of their colleagues. Did I do the right thing? Are my colleagues doing the right thing? You know, when I look back on this in 5 years, can I be proud of the work that I am doing? In a different type of scenario, we might have a more evolved science to rely on. But the uncertainty, the novelty, the ever-changing guidance that people are getting really undermines, you know, that kind of effective and confident decision-making.
Is the management of triage not for everybody? In other words, do you have to have certain traits to be able to make those terrible decisions so that one life is worth more than another, basically?
I mean, effectively, to make a triage decision, you have to have a very sophisticated understanding of the phenomenon. You need to know all the nuances, all the differentials, all the different ways that the disease can present itself, and enough history with the illness to be able to project a trajectory, to be able to say, based on this profile, you know, this is likely how this will go. And that type of confidence and knowledge and data comes over time. It comes from being very familiar with the guidance that is coming out of, you know, the CDC and other places. That guidance has to be firm and based in a, you know, a kind of longitudinal understanding of the disease. Again, this is a relatively new disease that we know very little about. We're learning, and we can borrow from other kinds of pandemics like SARS and other things. But we are still at the beginning of our knowledge base. And I think that really does, even for this more sophisticated professional who can handle the triage, is really making that very difficult.
Well, Dr. Sprang, I wonder if you could help us all here, arm us, if you will, on the chance that we might find ourselves, heaven forbid, or a loved one, admitted as a COVID-19 patient. What would you tell us that we need to bear in mind about the people who will be taking care of us, about how we interact?
Well, I guess one thing that I could mention is that how we respond to a threat is biologically based. How we respond to a crisis is driven by our biology and the way our brain protects us in times of threat. And so we professionals, like everybody around us, will respond in ways that is meant to promote our own survival. So if you're interacting with a provider and they're abrupt, emotionally distant, you know, maybe if they seem insensitive to the experience, it could be because internally they feel quite the opposite. The magnitude of what they're dealing with may feel overwhelming to them, and they're withdrawing to self-protect. That doesn't mean it's the right thing, but it might be a little glimpse into this human nature that we have. And, you know, just like it's our human nature, it's our desire and need to do right by others. So, you know, I'm hoping that COVID is going to teach us something about resilience in the time of great uncertainty, both for professionals and for the public.
There's no doubt there will be a volume of lessons on the other side of this thing, huh?
Yes.
Dr. Jenny Sprang with the University of Kentucky Department of Psychiatry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As that great philosopher Rosanna Dana once said,
it just goes to show you. It's always something. If it's not one thing, it's another.
Never in recent memory has Ms. Rosanna Dana's observation been more spot on than in the year 2020, and especially when what you're talking about is this global coronavirus pandemic. Seems every day we learn of some new way that it's turning up, unanticipated, uninvited, into some new corner of our lives. That's certainly the case where the management and brokerage of restaurant space and commercial office property are concerned. Joining us to tell us about some of the changes in the office and the work environment inspired by this pandemic is Jamie Schrader, owner of Schrader Commercial Properties in Lexington. Thanks for joining us, Jamie.
Tom, thank you very much. I'm excited to be on Eastern Standard, and I'm also excited to tell you a little bit about what we're observing in the commercial real estate market during the COVID-19.
Tell us what sorts of major changes that you've been encountering.
Well, I mean, basically, I think we're 6 months into this from the standpoint of our business situation, as mid-March was the starting point where people started to work from home, where offices started to close. So we're almost exactly 6 months into this cycle. And one of the things that came up immediately is people are concerned about cleaning, janitorial, sanitary. Those are issues that we immediately had questions about. If you've got anybody that's involved in medical, they are particularly concerned about that. So that's one of the first things we received inquiries about. You know, how can we keep the offices clean and sanitary? And we're working on that with our cleaning staff. Obviously, there's an emphasis on touch-free at this point in time. Anytime you don't have to touch a handle or a door, that's a desired thing. So that was probably the first thing we noted. And then some people just immediately closed their operation because they had to, starting in mid-March.
So, Jamie, what kind of trends, for better or worse, are you seeing going on right now in real time?
One of the trends, Tom, is in the multifamily or the apartment business. There is a huge number of 20-somethings that are now living at home. I saw a statistic recently that said approximately one-half of all 20-somethings are now living at home. Now, that was a trend that was already continuing over the last 5 years due to some economic uncertainty and younger people in the workforce having trouble getting started in careers, and also student debt. But COVID-19 has really resulted in a lot of 20-somethings moving home. They may have been in an urban setting where they didn't want to continue living there. Maybe their office closed. Maybe their apartment lease expired, and it was an opportunity to save money. So you're really seeing more people moving to their parents' home. And also, there seems to be a little bit of a trend, I don't know if it's long-term or not, with a little bit of movement to the suburbs, where you have a little more green space, a little more open air, a little more social distancing. So it'll be really interesting to see how our big urban centers that have been growing so rapidly are impacted by this long-term.
A lot of companies are contemplating keeping workers home for quite a while. I read that Netflix chief Reed Hastings, who's no fan of remote work, told the Wall Street Journal that he's anticipating bringing workers back 6 months after a vaccine becomes available, and that's down the road. Are you hearing of employers using this time to kind of rethink what their offices are going to look like when employees do finally return?
Definitely, in all aspects. What most people need to realize, though, is typically office space, particularly, is under lease. Sometimes those leases may be for 5 years, 7 years, maybe as far as 10 years. So the corporation or the company is obligated under the lease, and it's harder for them to take significant steps when they have that existing lease in place. But people are rethinking how their offices are going to look, how many people will be in the offices. We had experienced a shift toward the open floor plate, which you've probably seen, Tom, as you're moving around from place to place, more density in the workplace, set up for collaboration, which meant you have more people and less square footage. That obviously was a savings to companies. When they could pack more people in a smaller workspace, they had less rent burden. But that model may be changing over time, and I expect to see more individual offices. And while you might have people working from home, those people that lease office space may indeed lease more space per employee than they have in the past.
I've been hearing about the so-called dynamic workplace, which is turning away from the open plan, with the idea that with fewer employees coming to work on any given day, that offices can offer those who do come in more flexibility of layout and management. Are you hearing of any innovations in that regard?
I think some companies are able to adapt easier than other companies and can innovate more. Clearly, tech companies are better positioned to have people working from home, and it's easier for them to have people working from home than other types of industries. The reason some companies are coming back to work, like J.P. Morgan Chase, they just announced recently that they're going to ask all their traders to be back in the office by September 21st. That's because they want their people talking, collaborating, communicating, exchanging ideas. So I think the flexibility in the workspace has a little bit to do with how companies do business, what their industry is, and what their objectives are. It is hard for some people to work from home. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to be in a 500-square-foot apartment in Manhattan all day long working from home. Some people, believe it or not, Tom, like to go to the office. That's part of their routine. And I don't think this is going to be the death knell of office. I do think you will see more innovation as these leases come up for renewal and as people try to determine how much space they need, how they want to have it configured, and how their new office space will look going forward.
It's going to be an interesting time to study human behavior under these situations. I know there have already been some studies that have found employees who've returned already to these dynamic workplaces, as they're called. They're complaining that they can't find their colleagues. It's a hassle to find a new spot to work every day because it changes. That the layout ignores our innate penchant for, you know, you stake out a chair in that conference room, and when there's a meeting every week, that's the chair you go to. Do you see these human traits as maybe obstacles to making a successful transition to more non-traditional workspace configurations?
I think that can be an obstacle. I've seen these spaces you're describing where no one has an assigned workstation, where you come in and you put your computer down in a docking station and anybody can sit anywhere they want to. Typically, those are tech companies. Typically, they're companies that operate paperless. One of the problems you have in an environment like that, not just from a COVID-19 standpoint, is how many distractions happen. If you're sitting at a desk, there's five people right beside each other, and someone is walking by all the time, your eyes are going to look away from your work product or your computer screen, and that's a little bit of a distraction. And even before COVID-19, I had heard some complaints about too many people, too much density, and less productive workspace. So I think the main thing that is definitely going to occur is we're going to see, as I mentioned earlier, people having fewer employees per square foot than they have right now. Okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, as far as the innovation goes, I have heard about, while they might still have open space, there may be more ways to separate the space. And that could be anything from plexiglass to plantings. So they're kind of taking the current open floor plan and creating work areas in there that are different than what they had previously.
What are you hearing from your restaurant clients about innovations, workarounds, way they're figuring out how to keep going forward under really difficult circumstances?
Well, it's a very hard market for most restaurateurs. Some restaurants just don't lend themselves to a good carryout program because of the type of food they're preparing. Maybe they have so much rent and overhead that it doesn't make sense for them to try to do strictly carry out. Unfortunately, in Lexington, our weather is not like a Mediterranean climate or Southern California, and it's going to get cold.
Mm-hmm.
And more restaurants will lose their outdoor seating. Now, I'm sure you'll see more innovation there. There are going to be more people putting up tents, and there's going to be more heaters outside, and they're going to do everything they can to extend that season. But that's really a problem for a lot of restaurants. Probably the main bright spot right now would be quick service restaurants, and particularly those that have a drive-through window. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, as you drive around town, you've probably seen the lines backing up at McDonald's, Chick-fil-A. Just a huge amount of volume going through the drive-thru,
yep.
Even if they're open still. People don't want to get out of their car, don't want to go inside. So the restaurants, they're struggling, and some more so than others, depending on the type of restaurant that they operate.
Such interesting times. And as you said before, the one thing that's certain right now is the uncertainty that we're dealing with.
Very uncertain times. And it makes it hard for companies to make business decisions. And that's one of the trends we're seeing. Things are taking longer. Anybody that doesn't have to make a business decision right now, for the most part, will do their best to defer making a decision. They want more time to assess things. So if you don't have a lease that's coming up for renewal right now, if you don't have a compelling reason to expand your business in 2020, a lot of people are kind of sitting on the sidelines in a lot of areas. And that's a little bit of a challenge for us.
We're hearing from the chief medical officer of the World Health Organization that a return to pre-COVID life is not likely until sometime in 2022. What do you see when you look down the road?
Oh, the longer it goes on, the more people will innovate. When I say people, I'm talking about organizations, companies, and individuals. You mentioned a vaccine earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The governor changed his restrictions, but what you also have to have are people that are confident and willing to go outside, willing to go to a restaurant. Even if there's a change in restrictions, that doesn't mean someone that's 75 years old is just going to go out and immediately start conducting their life and their operations like they did pre-COVID. I don't think it's going to be an immediate return to normal, even if we come up with a vaccine and cases are reduced. It's going to be a gradual situation where people start moving around and spending and doing business like they did previously. So I think that's the one thing. As it goes on longer, you'll see more fundamental changes in business.
Well, I think one big irony that I'm seeing kind of operate throughout this is that while it's been terrible for so many businesses, there are some out there who, and I'm not saying that they're exploiting the situation, it just happens that they provide services or product that is needed. And I'm thinking of tents, heaters, seating, that kind of thing for outdoor restaurant service.
No question about it. And some sectors of the real estate market, commercial real estate market, are doing better. Let me give you an example. Self-storage. More people are moving out of their apartments. More people are moving in with their parents, 20-somethings. The self-storage business has been quite busy. The industrial market has been very busy. Typically, you're warehousing goods. I think of an Amazon fulfillment center. The industrial market continues to be fairly strong. All types of bulk warehousing space, data centers. Medical had a very tough period when patients weren't coming in, but the medical business, commercial real estate sector, continues to be pretty solid. And then I mentioned earlier, anybody with a drive-through or quick service restaurant like a Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, we see those as being the businesses and commercial real estate sectors that are doing best. And of course, anything that's an essential business where people have to go in, like a grocery store.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lexington Commercial Properties broker Jamie Schrader. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Coming up after the break, a visit with Kentucky's new Commissioner of Education after 1 week on the job.
Right now, everything is all COVID all the time, or at least it feels like that. It seems like every solution that comes forward also brings two new problems that you have to keep working through or something new that you have to think about.
And why the history of hemp in Kentucky is not complete without mentioning who once did all the hard work.
It's Black Kentuckians who do the work. And when we write them out of this story, we really do the history a disservice.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hickson Funson, Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
For this week's installment of our ongoing weekly series on teaching our kids during this pandemic, we hear from the person sitting at the desk where the buck ultimately stops, Kentucky's brand new education commissioner, Jason Glass. Dr. Glass comes to Kentucky from serving as superintendent for a large school district in the Denver area. He's also served as the top education official for the state of Iowa. WFPL's Jess Clark sat down with Glass to get his thoughts after his first week on the job.
What are your impressions so far about what the biggest challenges are for the department when it comes to supporting schools in this moment?
Right. Well, it's right now everything is all COVID all the time, it feels like that. It seems like every solution that comes forward also brings two new problems that you have to keep working through or something new that you have to think about. In spite of that, we've also got budget challenges that we're starting to work through here at the department. We're looking at an 8% planned cut to state agencies, and that's the funds that flow into the Kentucky Department of Education also have some impact on school services and direct services to kids, so trying to figure out what that looks like. Ongoing work around anti-racism and equity, thinking about that. And at some point, we'd love to get to a conversation around the future of education and what school could be in the state, but that's a little further down the road as we continue to work through this crisis.
So the General Assembly is going to meet in January. You were at the Department of Education in Iowa. You made some pretty significant policy changes to the teaching profession in that state. You created a professional teacher ladder. Teachers were incentivized to take on leadership positions. Are you thinking about any big major policy reforms or changes to the teaching profession here in Kentucky?
Well, I think the first thing that I'm going to work on in Kentucky is doing a lot of listening. That's really a lesson that I learned in Iowa, too. The first year that I was the chief state school officer in that state, they call the position director there, but it's the same role as commissioner in Kentucky. We put forth this big education reform plan the very first year out of the gate, and it was just landed like a lead balloon. The reason was that we didn't take the time to understand the context and think about what was right for that state. Now, I think we learned our lesson and came back a year and a half later with a much better plan that passed unanimously with support from both parties, from the business community and from the education community. So I think that's a lesson that I bring to Kentucky, is that we need to slow down and make sure that whatever policies that we put in place are the right ones.
So charter schools are a hot button issue here in Kentucky, as they are in most states. We have a law that allows for the creation of charter schools, but we do not have yet a funding mechanism. So right now we have no charter schools in the state of Kentucky. Do you believe there is a role for charter schools in Kentucky?
Well, I've had the experience working with charter schools in Iowa and in Colorado. In fact, the district that I just left had 15 charter schools, and I worked to support them. And the reason for that is if you move beyond the ideology of them, I always felt like those schools are serving kids in my community, and I want them to succeed because of that. And so I treated them just like any other school and thought, how can I help this school be successful? The charter school structure is really just a different governance approach. It moves the control and authority of the school away from the school district into and a more independent body. And the charter is a contract that establishes the boundaries of what that independent body can do. I think that charter schools have brought innovative approaches, a lot of more focused or mission-specific schools have come into being in states that have had charter schools. At the same time, I think they're a mixed bag. Their results are sort of variable from charter school to charter school, and they have increased inequities. So we have seen charter schools that have been created purely for the purpose of getting affluent white families a place to concentrate their students. So that exacerbates the inequity. And proliferating a bunch of new schools is not a very efficient strategy from a cost standpoint. So I think those are all things that we have to consider as well. I think the biggest question for the state is how, from a state policy level, how do we raise the performance and experience for students across the state? I have not seen evidence that charter schools, just the mere presence of them, does that. So while I think they may have a place, and Kentucky has a law that allows them to come into being, I'm not convinced that that is going to be the game changer that really changes the student experience, because fundamentally it's just a governance or structure change.
Great. Commissioner Glass, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Jess Clark interviewing Kentucky's new Commissioner of Education, Jason Glass. And you can find a longer version of this interview at WFPL.org. We hear quite a lot these days about hemp and its prominent role in Kentucky history. Not often mentioned is the labor that enabled the Kentucky hemp industry to become a powerful component of the Kentucky economy well into the 20th century, interrupted for decades due to its relationship with marijuana, but now legal again. Dr. Andrew Patrick, assistant professor of history at Center College in Danville, has made a study of that labor force, and he's joining us right now. Thank you, Dr. Patrick.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And let's begin with the basics. Who did the heavy work for Kentucky's 19th and 20th century hemp farmers?
It is black Kentuckians. By and large, black men and black boys are the people who actually performed the labor required for Kentucky's hemp crop. There would have been some white men who did some labor on small plots as well, especially in the 18th century and very early 19th century. But by the antebellum period, it is overwhelmingly being done by literal black hands that are cultivating and processing the hemp crop. And if you look at a map of hemp-producing counties compared to a map of enslavement in Kentucky, they really mirror each other to a striking degree, and they're both concentrated in this bluegrass region. So Fayette and the contiguous counties are really the heart of the hemp-producing region. And those are also counties with some of the highest enslaved populations, so upwards of 35-40% in many cases.
So in your studies, you found that whites at the time claimed that only blacks were capable of doing such difficult and dangerous work. What was involved?
Yeah, so it's a labor-intensive process at different points in the calendar, but there are some kind of gaps in that calendar as well. So starting in the spring with planting, and then there is a little bit of early weeding and tending to the very young crop. But then pretty quickly, hemp grows to an extent that it can shade out competing plants, so there's not kind of that greatest need during the growing season itself. But then the real labor begins with harvest. They were never quite able to perfect a harvester that was nearly as effective at maintaining this delicate fiber as hand harvesting. So this would literally be black men and black boys in fields cutting the hemp plants as closely to the ground as possible. So you're bending over for, you know, hours on end cutting these plants and stacking them. Another kind of labor choke point was after the hemp had been in the field rotting to kind of begin breaking down the gummy resin that connected the valuable fibers to the kind of worthless stalk that surrounded it. And in this process, it's another heavily labor-intensive hand process. They would set up and they would build what were called hemp breaks, which look a bit like a crocodile's jaw. And the process would be to repeatedly place these long stalks of hemp across the teeth of the hemp break and then slam it down repeatedly while kind of rotating the stalks of the fiber so that the woody portion would fall away beneath the break and then the valuable fibers would be left there. So this is an incredibly difficult, laborious job that has to go on for hours and hours at a time. Only about 1/6 of the weight of the plant is actually the fiber that you're wanting. So you're trying to break away the other 5/6 of it, and you're working at this extremely monotonous task throughout the day, breaking hundreds of pounds potentially of the finished product. So talking much more of the kind of raw hemp that goes in.
You mentioned that this was the work of men and boys, so children were used in the hemp fields and industry. Any idea how young? What was typical?
You see very frequent advertisements for boys as young as 12, and they would come into the process typically for the manufacturing stage. So after it has been broken out into that fiber, then those fibers would be processed into some finished goods, so something like rope or bagging that could be used for some additional purpose. So you'd see advertisements looking to hire or buy black boys as young as 12 so that they could work in hemp manufactories or work in rope walks, kind of spinning this raw material into a finished good. Again, this is a difficult job, and it has some health consequences potentially. These are often kind of very dusty environments, and it gives rise to something known as hemp pneumonia. So infections of the lungs can be a product of working in these really dirty environments for extended periods as you're spinning fiber into a rope, for example.
We're talking about slave labor here, and hemp farmers, you have written, offered bonuses for breaking the most hemp or exceeding some sort of quota. Was this work so hard that even enslaved people had to be incentivized?
Yes, I think that's a good way to think about it. These bonuses, if you want to call them that, would be quite small. So a penny a pound for exceeding a daily quota. Daily quotas would be something like 80 to 100 pounds that would be expected to be clean, broken hemp fiber at the end of the day. And if you go over that, some white farmers would offer kind of a bonus as an incentive. And really, that's an incentive to unlock the creative potential and the considerable skill that these enslaved Kentuckians possessed, in that they were able to, in some cases, break 50 or even in some cases 100 pounds more than that quota, but would be unlikely to do so without some sort of incentive. And it also, I think, creates a structure in which there are very strong reasons that people try to meet that quota, right? So by offering some incentive for exceeding it, you've got a much better chance of a larger number of people actually meeting that quota as well. So it's very much a tactic to try to motivate people who would otherwise not be particularly motivated to exceed that quota.
And I guess an overriding motivation would be the possibility of saving up enough from those bonuses to buy your own freedom.
Yes. So that would be a goal for many of these people who are working this backbreaking labor day after day, season after season, year after year, decade after decade, trying to accumulate capital. But if you're thinking about it in a penny at a time, literal penny at a time, and then you're trying to build to a total of say $800 or $1,000 or $1,200, you begin to see what a monumental task this would be to try to build that amount of money. And of course, all of this is kind of predicated on an idea that that owner would be open to a sale, which was definitely not always the case. And I think in many times, and especially in hindsight, this structure has been used as evidence for the benevolence of Kentucky slavery as opposed to slavery in the Cotton South, for example. And I really think that that misreads the prevalence of that sort of occurrence, someone buying their own freedom via the bonuses that are offered for hemp breaking. So that's a very, very extremely rare outcome. And it also fundamentally underplays the incentive structure on the other side of that equation. For every 50 or 100 extra pounds that you're able to extract from an enslaved person, there are, of course, economic payoffs for that enslaver in the marketplace. A one-cent bonus doesn't begin to address the profits that are made off of selling that excess breaking.
You pointed out that the labor requirements weren't as consistent throughout the year or as heavy as that of cotton plantations. And so that can help explain the sale of enslaved people from Kentucky to the cotton country down south. Can you elaborate on that bit for us?
Yeah, I think it ties in a bit with the fact that hemp is such a dense crop and it shades out competing and weed species. So there's that period when it is growing during the growing season where it needs very relatively minimal labor. And that breaking that we've been discussing can happen in otherwise slow periods in the agricultural cycle. So breaking would happen in the winter, so in late January, February, early March, a time when labor requirements were relatively low. And the overall system of Kentucky slavery was quite flexible, and that's tied into the diverse crops that are grown. Hemp farmers would be growing multiple other crops as well. It wouldn't be the sole crop. And that's a very different system than the Cotton South, where it's more of a monoculture and the plant itself needs more constant care throughout its growth cycle. And so this is part of the broader context that sees tens of thousands of enslaved Kentuckians forcibly sold and removed from the state to end up in the cotton-producing states of the Lower South. So there really is kind of that fundamental connection in the people who are doing these things. And then there are also connections between some of the hemp producers in Kentucky and then cotton farmers in the deeper South, often family or business connections. And additionally, the finished products that are coming out of these Kentucky farms and Kentucky manufacturers become part of the cotton economy. Hemp bagging and hemp rope often is used in baling cotton that's grown in the Lower South so that it can be transported to distant markets. So if you see a bale of cotton traveling to Liverpool or to New York or to Boston, often it is covered in Kentucky hemp. So there's kind of a fundamental physical connection between the two economies as well.
So, Dr. Patrick, how did hemp farming play a role in the system of slave rentals that characterized Kentucky slavery?
It's part of this cultural idea that hemp can only or is best produced by black Kentuckians. And this system of slave rentals that develops allows non-slaveholding white Kentuckians to nonetheless benefit from and tap into the labor of enslaved Kentuckians. So if you decide that you wanted to have a hemp crop and you did not yourself own slaves, you could then rent slaves to produce and break that crop for you. So it contributes to kind of a lower capital requirement to enter hemp growing, and then it provides return on that investment in human beings for the enslavers themselves, the people who are renting out their human property to others who are engaged in the hemp industry. So it is one piece of what is really a very flexible slave system in central Kentucky. And some of those enslaved people who are being rented out are those young boys we were talking about earlier. So some of these boys are rented for a year to work in a manufactory or in a rope walk or something. And then when they are larger and more physically powerful, able to perform tasks like breaking, they might then later in life have a different role within this same hemp economy. And all of that is kind of facilitated by this system of slave rentals.
What sort of living conditions did these children have available to them after such a long, hard day's work?
It would have been incredibly modest by modern standards, certainly. Something like a Lexington manufactory that employed dozens of people would have had something along the lines of a dormitory, but not in the collegiate sense, in the 21st century sense, but some concentrated housing that is very close to or connected with the factory itself.
Mm-hmm. The culture around today's revived hemp industry is much more progressive than it was in the old days. Of course, we're talking about the days of slavery. But today, are black farmers getting into the hemp game?
I think they are beginning to. I think there are some examples, certainly in the broader region of the Upper South. But there is kind of a huge and continuing disconnect between Kentucky's past and Kentucky's present in terms of the representation of black Kentuckians in agriculture generally. Less than 2% of Kentucky farm operations are led by black people, which is a far lower percentage than in the general population, certainly. And there are barriers to entry into the modern hemp industry in terms of capital requirements, in terms of navigating a very complex bureaucracy that governs and regulatory framework that governs hemp production at the moment. But there are, I think, some signs of improvement, some signs for hope. Organizations like Black Soil, which is a group based out of Lexington, are working to expand agricultural opportunities to black Kentuckians. I would really encourage people to check out the work that Ashley and Trevor are doing with Black Soil. It's quite impressive. And I think that that can be part of hemp's future, is that it can be a more accessible and equitable crop than it ever has been in our history, certainly. And I think that that needs to be an explicit goal as we move forward with our new and revived hemp industry. And perhaps there are policy solutions that could be discussed, but it needs to be something that is certainly part of the conversation. Because we do, I think, in the Kentucky hemp industry, want to benefit from this history of production, this history of leading the nation in hemp. But we need fundamentally to acknowledge who allowed that leadership. It's black Kentuckians who do the work. And when we write them out of this story, we really do the history a disservice. And I think doing that history a disservice has profound implications for the future of the industry in the state.
Dr. Andrew Patrick, he's assistant professor of history at Centre College in Danville. Thank you, Dr. Patrick.
Thank you.
A reminder that you can find current and past editions of Eastern Standard, the interviews, and all of our 10 recurring series on our website at esweku.org. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And the door's open to ideas. If you have one that you would like for us to consider, email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.